Let's take up our story today in Genesis chapter 12, verse number 4. It is the official beginning, I would say, of the Abram story, the Abrahamic story. Abram's father, Terah, had moved his family from Ur of the Chaldees, the authentic location of which is at Sanli Urfa today in Turkey. He took his whole family from Ur and started moving them toward Canaan. And it seems as if he was doing this as a response to what his son Abram had said about a call of God, a call from the Creator to do exactly that. But they only get about 25 miles down the road to an ancient location called Haran. It's apparently a crossroads of traffic of different traveling groups. And there they stop. And there Terah dies. And then Abram becomes the head of the family. He is now the patriarch of the Terah family. And so he continues the trip south. He allows, apparently, gives permission for his younger brother Nahor to remain at Haran with his family, and that is where we will find them later. But he takes his nephew, Lot, which is, this guy is probably not too far from the same age as Abram, because Abram's elder brother was 60 years older than him. And so he takes Lot as kind of his ward, if you will, because in this patriarchal society, the eldest member of the family called the shots for everybody else. And they start heading south toward Canaan. It's about almost 2 weeks travel, depending on how hard you push your animals. And this is what we know from the text, Genesis 12, 4. So Abram went, as he who is had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So that makes him about 5 years older than his dad was when the eldest son was born to him. So Abram's been married for a little while, but they're not having any kids. Verse number 5. Abram took Sarai, his wife, who is actually his half-sister. They don't share the same mom, but they share the same dad. They don't have any kids. And Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. Now, what we don't often talk about is that Abram, as the eldest surviving son, received the double share of his father's possessions, meaning everything that his father Terah owned was divided up into three parts, and he got two of those parts, the other part going to his brother Nahor. Lot would have been given something, perhaps, from his grandfather, Terah, that would have been his own possession. But all of these possessions, all of these accumulations of Terah have now passed on, in large part, two-thirds of them, to Abram. So he is very wealthy. He has a lot of stuff. And it's not just simply animals and materiel. He has servants. He is, in effect, a traveling town. a tent city, if you will, because he's living a Bedouin lifestyle. And so he has all these employees that work for him, and many of them have grown up with him, having been born to servants of his father and his father's father before him. And so all of those people that they had acquired, they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the Oak of Moreh. Now, Shechem, we know exactly where it's at. It's between two prominent hills. In fact, it gets its name from the fact that those two hills are like two shoulders on either side of the city of Shechem. Shechem has to do with shoulder. And there is a prominent tree. Now, it has oak in our English Bible. It's actually a terebinth tree of some sort. It's pretty good size. And what we know historically is that some of these larger trees became gathering places for community trading and also for worship sites, because that way you could find it easier from a distance, because you knew that it was near a certain geographical area, maybe near a certain town, but it was under a certain large tree. And so this tree is mentioned here. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. So he stops at Shechem, between the two mountains, underneath this tree, and he starts talking to God. He probably offers worship. In fact, the word Moreh here means fear or respect or reverence. And it's probably a reference to the idea that he was turning this into his first worship site at Canaan, in the land of Canaan. He would have traveled, by the way, down the ancient royal highway, the ancient king's highway, which came from the bend in the Euphrates River, where the Balik River was coming from the north. It's the Balik River Valley that Haran is located on. So he would have come from Haran down that Balik Valley, would have joined the ancient travel highway there, and would have gone southward past what eventually is going to be Damascus, and then passing along the east side of where the Sea of Galilee is, and along the east side of the Jordan Valley. But then, apparently, about halfway down that parallel to the Jordan Valley, he turns right, he turns westward, and goes down into the Jordan Valley and up again to this prominent place called Shechem. Now, why does he do that? Well, there's a cross highway there. There's a cross pathway that travels that direction. So Shechem officially becomes his first major campsite inside the boundaries of the land of Canaan, which is where he was told to go. He probably builds an altar, talks to God, and God talks to him. Verse 7. Then he who is appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring, and this is the word for seed, it's singular, it is a collective singular, meaning it can mean one particular descendant, but it can also have in mind a whole group of descendants. So to your seed, and I'm going to do this consistently, I think, is instead of using the English Standard Version's offspring, I prefer the more literal seed. Okay? So to your seed, I will give this land. That is the land of Canaan where he's camping out. So he built there an altar to he who is, who had appeared to him. So this is the first official worship site of Abram in the Promised Land. In fact, this is where he is told inside the Promised Land, I'm giving this land to your seed. This probably contributes to why the Israelites coming out of Egypt and entering into the Promised Land, their first major worship gathering will be at Shechem. It is the place where they will do the blessing and cursing ceremony. And more than likely, it's related to the idea that that's where Abraham first had his contact with God in the Promised Land. Verse number 8. From there, he moved to the hill country on the east side of Bethel. So leaving Shechem, there is another road system that kind of follows the top of the ridge line that goes from north to south here in Canaan, in the Promised Land. And about one day's travel south would take him to this area between a city called Luz at this time and a city called Ai. And so he pitched his tent with Bethel, that's a more modern name, it's the city of Luz on the west side, and Ai on the east side. And there he built an altar to he who is and called upon the name of the Lord. So remember again, he is living a Bedouin lifestyle. So he goes someplace and he sets up an encampment and worships God there. And that's his headquarters. That's where his tent city is located. But he's grazing his animals all around. Now, we'll discover later that he follows a pattern of paying for grazing rights and water rights from the locals. So when he came to Shechem, there's little doubt in my mind that he got in touch with the local officials and said, I'd like to buy water and grazing rights for here for a while. And so he grazes his sheep and his cattle and spends a little time there. Then, after an indeterminate time, he packs up and moves south. About a day's travel, sets up another location. First thing he does, he puts an altar in place. He worships God, devotes his time and his efforts to God, and then buys the grazing and watering rights from the locals, and then he does the same thing again there at Bethel and Ai. It's very little surprise again that Bethel becomes an important worship site during the divided kingdom period, because it was already attached to Abram, the father of the Israeli nation. So they finish there for a while, and then verse 9, Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. Now, Negev, in its most technical sense, I think it just means southland. It's the reference to the upper portion of the Sinai Peninsula. As you travel southward, somewhere around the line east and west, just south of Bethlehem but north of Hebron, it starts getting drier and drier, and eventually it turns into the Sinai Peninsula desert. So the northern part of that is called the Negev. So he travels southward, heading down toward that area, and it is there that he realizes things are bad. Something happens. It may be that he had been raising some localized crops at each of his sites, like at Shechem and at Bethel, and that suddenly now there is a drought that settles in. And it's a bad drought. Verse number 10 says, "Now there was a famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land." So in his travel southward, it's not so much the Negev that causes him trouble, it's the fact that there is this widespread famine everywhere. And that's a pretty big deal. That means that the weather pattern coming off the Mediterranean has failed, because the Mediterranean typically brings storms across the coastline and then up and over the central ridgeline, and it drops all of this water and refills the water table. And so this land was very lush. It was very verdant. It was very green and productive. Even the Jordan Valley at this time, highly productive and very green. But as the storms travel farther and farther east, they lose all of their moisture energy, and you end up with the empty quarter of the Arabian Peninsula, which is a big desert. But the Promised Land itself, very nice, unless you lose your weather pattern off of the Med, and then it dries out quick. And so Abram does what traditionally the people of this region always do. They go down to a place that has a different weather pattern. And that's Egypt. See, because Egypt is not watered by the Mediterranean weather pattern. Egypt is watered by a weather pattern deep down in the heart of Africa, the great big monsoons that sweep across lower central Africa and then up into the Indian Ocean and into the Indian subcontinent and Malaysia and all of those places, the Philippines. They still experience this great big monsoon season. So the monsoon season fills all of the Nile River tributaries and floods the Nile every year like clockwork. And all of that new sediment-laden floodwater comes down and dumps everything along the lower Nile and especially in the Delta region. And so even if you lose the weather pattern in Canaan, you can go over to Egypt and there will be food available there because they get their grain growing from a weather pattern way down south. Okay, so verse 11. And it's about, again, about 2 weeks travel from lower Canaan over into the Delta region. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance." Now, those are great words for a lady to hear, right? You are a knockout. You are fantastic looking. She's probably, as I've said, we know that she's in her 66th year, something like that, upper 60s, because when they came to the Promised Land, he was 75, she's 9 years younger at 66. So she is part of this family that is very long-lived and very well proportioned and good looking. And so he says that. He says, "You are a good looking woman." Verse 12, when the Egyptians see you, they will say, hey, this is his wife. And then they will kill me, but they'll let you live. Now, this is an assumption that Abram makes that I believe is not called for. He assumes, having never met Egyptians in their homeland before, maybe he's heard rumors about them, he assumes they're all horrible, immoral people that take what they want and kill people that get in their way. And so he says, I want you to do something for me to keep that from happening. Verse number 13, say that you're my sister. Now, is that true? Technically, yes. She is his half-sister. But as a very wise woman that I know has said, even the intention to deceive is in fact a lie. Okay? So he's asking her to lie. Say that you're my sister, not my wife, basically, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. Now, this is another interesting assumption that he's making here. In this culture, in this time culture, the head of the larger family was like a king. He was the Lord. He called the shots. So if he had an unattached sister in his entourage, then you basically had to get permission from the patriarch of the family, the father of the family, to get married to her. And the custom was to really be lavish in your overtures toward that lord, toward that patriarch, in order to gain his favor so that he would give permission for the marriage. And so that's what he is depending on here, that they will treat him as Sarai's big brother and be nice to him in the hopes of being able to marry her, when in fact he had no plans at all of giving permission along that line. So he thought he had this covered. He made one really big error in his assumptions. Verse number 14. When Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. So exactly as he expected. When the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh is the head of all of these different powerful men in the Delta region and in Lower Egypt. This is at a time when Egypt was not united yet. So Lower Egypt was made up of smaller areas, many of it in the Delta region, but they had over them one guy. I think his headquarters was somewhere just south of the wrist of the Delta. And so they see this beautiful woman and they report to the top guy in their region, wow, she is a knockout. And by the way, her brother is very wealthy already. He's got a lot of stuff. He's here out of Canaan because of the famine going on up there. It would be a good idea to make an alliance with this family. And so that's exactly what Pharaoh does. And he is of the type, being, you know, the number one guy in the region, of not asking permission. He just assumes. So the woman, Sarai, was taken into Pharaoh's house. Basically, Pharaoh says, you know what? I love the way your little sister looks, and I want her to be my wife. Let's start making plans for the wedding. And so, verse 16, for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. What we're seeing here in verse 16 is basically the dowry. This is what he is giving, what Pharaoh is giving to the head of Sarai's household, the patriarchal head, in order to say, I will take good care of her, I promise. And so he had sheep and oxen and male donkeys and male servants and female servants. One of those female servants is probably Hagar. She comes into the story later. Female donkeys and camels. And so wedding plans are now being made. In that time period, in this cultural setting, some time would pass between the giving of the dowry and the actual official ceremony. During this time, the betrothed woman would sometimes live in the house of her future husband. So she's been moved into basically Pharaoh's palace, and plans are being made for a big wedding at some time in the future. And I am sure that Abram is at a loss. What am I supposed to do? This totally backfired on me. And Sarai is probably not a happy camper because she went along with her husband brother's plan. And now here she is, already married, but signed up for a new wedding to a guy that is in control of the land of Egypt. And so it is an absolute mess of Abram's makings. And one of the things we have to be honest about when we go through these stories is that choices sometimes made by heroes of the faith were not good, and they brought bad consequences. And that's one of these. And in those circumstances, because of those choices interfering with God's overall plan, God intervenes. And that is exactly what we see in verse 17. He who is afflicted Pharaoh in his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Mark your place there. We'll get back into the word next time.